Heart disease is the biggest cause of death in the world. One third of people will die to some form of cardiovascular disease. As a man, it's much more important to stay in better fitness and metabolic health and body composition than women. We can minimize our risk of chronic diseases and increase our life expectancy with lifestyle. That will only take us so far. It's not going to take us beyond 120. For every 100-year-old person who smokes, there's tens of millions of smokers who died in their 60s.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. So friends, are you ready to join me? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Friends, it is such an honor to have Seamland back on the show. He is truly one of the OGs when it comes to everything biohacking and the pursuit of longevity. He is honestly brilliant. His books blow me away with the insane amount of science and detail and knowledge he brings to this sphere. And in today's episode for his book, The Longevity Leap, we dive deep, deep, deep into all things longevity. We talk about the secrets of centenarians and super centenarians and what makes them so special, whether or not the benefits of fasting are only due to calorie restriction. I know that is a hot debate. Whether or not you should follow a low-carb or low-fat diet, the benefits of low cholesterol, how marriage and children affects lifespan, are there benefits to smoking and nicotine, the future of longevity, and so much more. The show notes for today's episode will be at melanieavalon.com/longevityleap. Those show notes will have a full transcript as well as links to everything that we talked about, so definitely check that out. Hi, friends. Did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/melanieavalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/melanieavalon. And new customers use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hey friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price, plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. I can't wait to hear what you guys think. Definitely let me know in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post, and again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. All right, without further ado, please enjoy this fabulous conversation with Seamland. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation I'm about to have. It is with a multiple times repeat guest, somebody I've been following in the biohacking sphere, honestly, for years and years, since I even got into all of this. I'm here with the incredible Seamland for his newest book, and it is called The Longevity Leap, A Guide to Slowing Down Biological Aging and Adding Healthy Years to Your Life. And Seam has quite a few books, and this book definitely lives up to all of his prior work. It is, oh my goodness, friends, it is the Bible of all the information you could ever want about longevity, things that affect our actual age, our biological age, all the things that people love, like hormesis and what we can see in long-lived populations and, you know, longevity supplements and diet and fat, different types of dietary fat and cholesterol and all the different things that the diseases of aging. And it's really, really mind-blowing. So there's no way we can even remotely touch on it. I'm really, really, really referring people to get this book. They can easily search for all the different topics. So I literally have like 30 pages of notes. Might just ask my super random questions I have about it. But Seam, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. And glad you liked the book.
Oh, I did. It's as per usual. It's such a deep dive. And I'm just always so impressed by how you, just everything that you do with your research. Actually, that's a good question to start with. When you sit down to research any one topic or write about a topic, going into it, do you have a pretty good idea of what you're going to find? Because you've been doing this for so long. So is it more like you have the ideas and then you find the research to support it? Or is it more actually looking for the answers as you're writing it?
Well, I definitely shouldn't, like, even if I do have some preconceived notions about a particular topic, I, you know, shouldn't let it be crystallized and dogmatic. So whenever I am researching some new topics about it or new things about a particular topic, then I typically do find new insights and, you know, might have to change my mind about certain things. update my belief systems, or not belief systems, but the factual understanding about certain topics. So when I'm, let's say, researching a book, then I typically like divide them into these multiple chapters, and each chapter, you know, focuses on each individual topic, and I just read a lot about that particular topic and just spend days going through a lot of studies. Usually if I find like a meta-analysis or like a review article about a particular topic, then that makes it a lot easier, because those review articles tend to already summarize a lot of the narrative and ideas about this topic. And I still go into like individual studies as well, with multiple angles to a particular topic. You can find some nice studies to support a particular claim, and you also find some studies that don't support it. So you need to try to analyze that and figure out, okay, what are the like pros and cons of each study, and then come to some sort of a conclusion.
Yeah, you're really good at that in your writing, and you know, noting where there's nuance and conflicting opinions. And actually, you even referenced a study about studies that I hadn't even seen, that was commenting on the potential credibility of epidemiological data compared to like randomized controlled trials, and how there was actually a lot of benefit there, like that they were pretty comparable. And actually, to that point, there's so many directions I want to go with this. I'll just briefly say, like, the chapter on cardiovascular disease risk and, you know, cholesterol levels and LDL and HDL, I really appreciated that chapter, because I feel like, especially in the biohacking world and like the keto world and the low carb world, there's a lot of intense opinions about cholesterol. And it was really nice to read your takedown. So maybe we can get into that. But quick question before that, because last time I brought you on, I should probably check, it was a few years ago now. When did you get married?
I got married in 2022. It was almost 3 years ago.
Okay. Well, congratulations. I'm pretty sure you were on before that. So I'm super curious, because you have a whole section on relationships and longevity. And your wife, is she around the same age as you?
Yeah.
Okay. What did you find with relationships and marriage and longevity in your book?
Yes, there is a very consistent link between having good relationships and longevity. You know, the reason for that probably has to do with many things. It, you know, even down to the simple thing that when you fall as an old person, then there will be someone to call the ambulance or something like that, to someone remind you to take your medications, or, you know, whatever, like these very practical things that will help a person to live for longer. But there's also obviously mental health benefits and happiness benefits and, you know, purpose related benefits, that if you have someone else to live for, you know, whether that be a partner or a children, grandchildren, or even a dog or some religion or something like that, the research does suggest that there is like a causal link between having a purpose and a why or a reason to live and longevity. So it does have a positive effect on your physical health as well. And the same applies to relationships, apparently, that there's a physical benefit to good social relationships, and not just the mental health side. When it comes to men and women, then it actually seems like men benefit more from marriage and partnership when it comes to longevity. For women, there's a weaker association between relationships and marriage and longevity. But for men, it's a lot stronger. Maybe it's because women already live slightly longer than men, so like about 5 to 10 years longer than men on average. So maybe they've already, you know, let's say, reaped a lot of the potential benefits from relationships when it comes to longevity, that the other things, that these other genetic or sex differences have already given them a lot of the longevity benefits, so they don't gain additional advantages. Whereas for men, you know, there's reasons why men tend to live shorter than women, probably with, you know, poorer lifestyle, some hormonal differences, higher rates of heart disease, alcohol and riskier behaviors, etc. So there might be some, let's say, drop-off effects from these relationships and marriage later in life that mitigate some of those increased risk men experience.
Yeah, I thought that chapter was so interesting. you even said at one point. So basically, and like with the age gap difference, basically for men, it benefited to marry younger, right? But for women, not so much.
Yeah, there is a men gain the best benefit from younger spouses, and women, there's no difference, if I remember correctly. And, you know, perhaps the reason men gain benefits more from younger spouses for longevity would be maybe that they would live longer. So like if you have a significantly older wife, then that wife would potentially die sooner as well. So maybe there is some of that effect. I would presume that would be the reason.
Gotcha. The kids thing. I'm haunted by the kids thing because I personally don't think that I want to have kids. So I'm always really curious how it affects and relates to longevity. So I'm curious what you found there. I've been quoting this study to people. You mentioned a study in the Amish. Was it their longevity or their happiness that was increasing?
For men, up to 14 kids was linked to a great pregnancy. But for women, it was something like 4 to 5 or something, so like slightly less than for men. So there is a, you know, physical, a biological burden that your body goes through when you're pregnant. And maybe if, you know, you have 10 kids or something, then there might be some effect on the speed of biological aging. Because if you look at these epigenetic age clock tests, then during pregnancy, the biological age does increase based on those tests. Now, you know, I don't know how accurate these tests are, but, you know, during pregnancy, your body goes through certain changes. If you do it 10 times in your life, then maybe there is some negative effects on maximum lifespan. But generally speaking, having kids is associated with longevity, multiple kids. But is it because if you have kids and grandkids, then later in your life, so a lot of with this research is that at what time point are we talking about? So like if you're 80 years old, then you know, you'll have someone who takes care of you, like grandchildren and children. And a lot of you know, regular elderly people, they might have more financial struggles. They might have disabilities and comorbidities that prevent them from taking care of themselves that properly. So they are just at a high risk of negligence or not being taken care of. And having kids and grandkids is one way to offset that risk. So that, you know, might be one of the reasons why kids are associated with increased longevity in the general population. Of course, you know, there might be some individual differences. You know, everyone can decide what they want to do with their life. Biologically speaking, you know, there is always the saying that getting kids ages you because you can't sleep that well. You'll have a lot more stress and worry and et cetera. They're like, you know, require a lot of financial assistance as well to raise kids. So there's always the counter argument that don't have kids because of all these reasons. But based on all the research, it's the opposite, that these kids actually will be a bigger predictor of your longevity later in life. For various reasons.
Yeah, the thing I wonder about it is, at least for the woman, because, you know, supposedly or apparently our purpose is to have children, is there any sort of extension of the biological age clock? Because if a woman hasn't had a child, is the body still like waiting to have a child? So I just wonder if it, you know, would increase longevity from that perspective.
Well, what we do know is that women who have children later in life do have better longevity, probably because if you are able to have children in your 40s and mid-40s, you are generally healthier as well. So it's maybe not a causal effect, that is a little more like a survivorship bias, that all the women who are able to have children in their mid-40s, then they're just healthier to begin with, and they are aging already slower biologically. You know, there is a, you know, let's say a deadline for getting children for women, and they're not going to be able to do it after menopause. Some women enter menopause later than others. I think that is associated with better longevity and slower biological aging to enter menopause a little bit later. And early menopause is often associated also with accelerated biological aging and shorter longevity. So if someone is able to have children later, then that is a good sign. To my knowledge, I don't think we can say that just having kids later, so in your mid-40s, that it immediately would mean that you will live longer. That is the reason why it is so. It's probably the reason that the woman who is able to have children in their mid-40s is healthier to begin with.
Right. Yeah, like causation, correlation. You mentioned the benefit of like grandparents, but there's specifically like the grandmother hypothesis. So what's the difference with the, like, why is the grandmother potentially more valuable when she's older?
Yeah, well, you know, we evolved in hunter-gatherer tribes in nature. Elderly people aren't particularly useful in a, like, this ancestral environment. They're not able to do that much physical labor. They can't hunt, you know, they might gather things, they can do certain household chores in the tribe, right? So what is the evolutionary reason why humans are able to live into their 70s and 60s and 80s? So one of the hypotheses is that elderly people are able to take care of grandchildren, so they can assist with raising kids. And, you know, humans have a very long developmental period, you know, where for, you know, multiple years dependent of our parents, you know, kids, even 10-year-olds, even 14-year-olds aren't able to survive themselves in nature alone. So they need to be grown up with parents, and the grandparents potentially help just with that. They help to grow or raise the children.
In the beginning of the book, you actually talk about your personal story and what you experienced with your family. So maybe you could tell listeners a little bit about that. So what was your experience growing up with your family and health? And I have a question about something you said. You said that you've never been sick. Do you mean a chronic type sickness, or do you mean you've never been like sick, like had a cold?
Well, I mean, obviously I've got a cold sometimes. Maybe once a year I do have a fever for 1 to 2 days, but I've never been sick in terms of any chronic disease or any medical health ailment.
What made you interested in health and longevity? It's such a, I mean, I clearly I'm into it as well. So what gets us here? What was your experience like growing up?
Yeah, so I was into fitness after high school. I you know, got into strength training and dieting and tracking nutrition and those things. And at some point, I decided also to take preventive health more seriously. And the reason was looking back, because my grandfather died to colorectal cancer when he was 36. And I didn't want to increase my risk of some chronic disease later in life with a more reckless or careless lifestyle. And 36 is, you know, very young for colon cancer. It made me realize that I don't have possibly like exceptional genetics for longevity or cancer. So it's not something that I'm immune to. So I need to take it a bit more seriously if I do want to live longer and reach a very high age. Another reason I'm interested in longevity is because of studying anthropology and being interested in the human species and human development. As an anthropologist, I'm interested in this idea of life extension and what would it entail. First of all, how do we actually do that? It's a very scientifically very fascinating question. It's one of the hardest problems humans have ever, you know, puzzled with. It's just fascinating for me to try to think about it and try to find a solution to that. So how do you slow down aging? How do you extend lifespan with the current means? And in the future, what would it entail if we do ever find some solution? Like, what would society look like if, rather than living to, you know, let's say mid-80s, we would live to 150 on average? That would be like, you know, pretty insane, like double the life expectancy. That would change society quite a lot, and it would obviously cause a lot of problems, but I think it also has a lot of, you know, positives to it. So I'm just curious and interested in that part of the question.
Yeah, the anthropology background is perfectly paired with all of it. I'm curious, so as the years go by and as you do all this research, especially with this incredible book and all of the information contained therein, and what you just mentioned with, you know, how things evolve and technology and findings about longevity, Do you think the answers for extending lifespan are, like, where do they mostly lie? Is it in more foundational things that everybody can do, like diet and fitness? Is it in, you know, more specific biohacking type protocols? Is it in, you know, supplements like, you know, rapamycin? Is it in something that's not even invented yet, and like gene therapy and stuff? Like where do you think the main answers are for people?
Currently, the only answer we have is a lifestyle that we can minimize our risk of chronic diseases and increase our life expectancy with lifestyle, but only that will only take us so far. You know, it's not going to take us beyond 120, which is thought to be the limit for human lifespan currently. So most people with a good lifestyle and a little bit of luck and minimizing unnecessary risks in their life, with that kind of approach, they can, you know, easily live to their 90s, maybe to 100s within the next 10, 20 years. But yeah, it's not going to be like a dramatic shift in life expectancy. For us to really move the needle, you know, we're talking people living over 100 and over 120. For that, you know, maybe rapamycin or some other analogous dura-protective drugs, maybe those will help to move us closer to that. But to really make us live to, you know, 150, 200, 250, we need something way more dramatical, something related to gene editing or whole body replacement. So starting to replace organs, growing artificial organs and replacing them, you know, that kind of thing. So currently we don't know what it would look like because we would have probably already done it. But when I talk about longevity, then I'm, you know, currently able to say only that you can modify your chronic disease risk and make you live a little bit longer in terms of health span and a few extra years to your life expectancy. So these things are not something that will, yeah, make you immortal or make you live significantly longer. But they are something that will increase your likelihood of, you know, living until we figure something out that will move the needle a lot more. So if you're alive for the next 10, 20, 50 years, you know, your likelihood of reaching some sort of technological breakthrough increases. Whereas if you're very reckless with your lifestyle, you're like speedrunning life, you might, you know, pass away before something like that happens. So the way I like to think about it is, you know, if you were to be 100% certain that, okay, in the year 2035, we will reach this breakthrough that a lot of scientists believe that we will, then you would just live in a basement and, you know, not fly, never fly, and not do anything risky. You would just live for the next 10 years as a hermit, just to make sure that for the next 200 years, so that you will be able to live for the next 200 years if you just you know, suffer for 10 years. So, but if it's 100% certainty, you would do that. Even like 90% certainty, many people would do that, right? But currently, I would say the likelihood of us reaching that breakthrough within the next 10 years is maybe 2% or something like that. It's obviously good and important to follow a healthy lifestyle, I guess. There's no rational reason to be like super neurotic about it. It's also important to kind of enjoy life because, like I said, the likelihood of us reaching this breakthrough is only, I would say, maybe 1 or 2%. Whereas if it was a 90 or 100%, then yeah, like it would be smart to just be ultra healthy and super strict with your lifestyle and take no risks for the next 10 years.
Hey friends, I'm about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Blow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. And then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com. Two thoughts there. One, that's a really interesting question. I have actually never thought about that. Like if I knew for certain, like in 10 years or even 5 years, that there was going to be some breakthrough, I'm just wondering like how much I would, I feel like everything I do right now, I feel pretty good about. And then like the hermit comment, like, yeah, would I take less risk, just risk with like driving or going on, you know, traveling? I don't know. Do you think if you knew for certain, like 5 years or 10 years, would you change anything you're doing right now?
Well, I wouldn't, you know, fly probably. flying is, you know, very safe, but there is still a non-zero chance, you know, I could not fly for the next 5-10 years. I don't think it would be like that big of a deal.
No skydiving.
For sure. You know, I think, yeah, like you do need to, you know, have some balance in life. And it's important to also, you know, I don't think that, so I don't find like enjoyment in, yeah, skydiving or and drinking or things like that. So I wouldn't do it anyway. But, you know, something else like that, you know, yeah, like flying for vacation, you know, you're gonna have a good time. So it's worth it right now because the likelihood of it being risky is very small. There's no huge upside as well to not traveling as of now.
Yeah. Honestly, getting in a car is probably one of the most dangerous things. And it's just so, like where you live in Estonia, do you travel by car a lot or is it more like walkable or biking or?
We do have a car. We don't drive with it like every day because everything is pretty close. The gym is walkable. The store is walkable. So, you know, most of the days I'm in my routine that, you know, I don't actually go any further away than like 1 kilometer from my house for most of the days. You know, I might drive a few times a week, some shorter distances.
I find it really interesting because you were mentioning about it's important to still have fun in life and not be neurotic. And I think people will often look to centenarians and super centenarians, which I love like studying and learning about. And you talk about them a lot in the book. And a lot of them will, you know, credit their longevity to a lot of their like bad habits, actually, like, oh, smoking, drinking, eating all the things. And then I think people will be like, well, people use that as an example saying, well, look at these, you know, centenarians doing this. So clearly that must be fine. When really, I feel like it's actually saying the opposite in a way, because the way I interpret it is these people have genes, like the perfect combination of genes that just so protects them from the aging, you know, concepts in their body that they can do these things. And like, there's, you know, no effect. So for those of us who don't have that, you know, lovely symphony of genes, we probably actually need to be even more in control of our lifestyle habits. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah. So like, you know, for someone to live over the age of 100, that's already like an exceptional accomplishment. So centenarians already make up 0.0001% of the population. So for someone to reach that age, then they do have to have something additional that works in their favor. The studies are, when what look at their lifestyles, then they're not a lot different from their peers. So they have the same diets, they have the same lifestyle as pretty much everyone around them. You know, they're not doing something miraculous in terms of their routines. They do, you know, have close relationships, they have a pretty healthy diet, but you know, they don't have some sort of a modern abomination of some sort of a, you know, these influencer diets or social media diets. They don't have a carnivore diet, they don't have a vegan diet, they don't have a, you know, paleo diet or something like that. They just eat a lot of different foods, and you know, yeah, they also eat some processed foods and ice cream and cookies and those kind of things. So they just have a pretty good genetics. And smoking is another thing that people like to bring up, that, you know, I have this smoking uncle who lived to 100 years old, etc. But, you know, for every 100-year-old person who smokes, there's tens of millions of smokers who died in their 60s. So it's a very false conclusion. And there's actually one study from 2004 that I found recently that looked at all the centenarians in Rome, which is they were had 157 centenarians. They found that 83% of them never smoked, 13.5% were former smokers, only 2.7% were active smokers. So even among all the centenarians, the smokers make up a super minority. And if you, you know, realize that, again, to reach the age of 100, it's already extremely low likelihood to begin with. So that same study was done in Rome. Back then in 2004, there was like 2.5 million people in Rome. And out of those, there was only 157 were centenarians. So that's like 0.0062% of the population of Rome were centenarians. And these 2.7% of the 157 centenarians were smokers. So out of all the people, the 2.5 million people in Rome, 0.00017% were 100-year-old smokers. So we're talking about like an extreme super minority of people who were smokers and over the age of 100. So yeah, it's often this anecdotal evidence makes a lot of headlines, good headlines, but yeah, the reality is, you know, pretty clear that smoking definitely isn't a longevity hack. And a lot of the times, these centenarians, they would have made it to 100 doing almost anything else as well. Like, it doesn't really matter if they smoked or not, but most of them still don't smoke.
Speaking of, do you ever use nicotine as like a supplement or a patch?
I use a nicotine gum every once in a while, but not very often.
I love nicotine. I use the nicotine patch, but like a very, very small dose. And I don't know, I guess I read the good stuff about it, like the, you know, the cognitive protective aspects of it. And it gives me a little dopamine hit. And it's such a small amount that if I don't, like if I forget to put it on, I don't notice, but I still like it. So
yeah, I think nicotine does have nootropic benefits, whether or not it has neuroprotective effects and reduce the risk of dementia is not clear, but I think that it's definitely a nootropic. You know, with that, just the amounts and frequency matters in high doses. I think it's something like over 10 milligrams a day. It has a vasoconstrictive effects, so reduces blood flow and can increase blood pressure. But in small doses, like 1-2 milligrams a day, tends to not be a problem.
Yeah, I take a 14 and I divide it by 4. So I do like 3.5, and that's like slow release over the day, 3.5 milligrams a day. Also with the centenarians, so you talk about there's three profiles. There's the survivors, the delayers, and the escapers. So what's happening there? And why are there more men that are escapers?
Yeah, so this particular study was done in Denmark. they discovered that the centenarians could be categorized into three groups. The survivors were the ones who were diagnosed with a particular chronic disease before the age of 80, and they still reached the age of 100. So they got kidney disease or hypertension or heart disease before 80, but they still survived until 100. Then you had the delayers. These delayed the onset of chronic disease until 80 and then reached the age of 100. And the last group was escapers. These avoided all these chronic diseases until the age of 100. So these are like the healthiest of the healthiest in terms of health span. The vast majority of all the centenarians belonged into the delayer or the escaper group. So only like 13% of centenarians belonged in the survivor group. Now that's a good and bad news. Like the good news is that if you are diagnosed with a particular comorbidity or chronic disease before the age of 80, you still have a chance of reaching the age of 100. So it's not like once you get some disease before 80 that it's, you know, game over, that you'll never reach 100. You know, 13% chance based on this study to reach centenarianhood. The bad news is, yeah, that the most effective, most reliable method to reach the age of 100 is to try to delay these chronic diseases and get them as late as possible. So ideally after the age of 80 and, you know, in a perfect world after the age of 100. And the reason men were more likely to be in the escaper group was that men have shorter life expectancy than women, and women are significantly more likely to reach the age of 100 than men. The ratio between 100-year-old men and women is something like 9-1 favoring women. So there's like a very small amount of men who live to the age of 100 to begin with. So centenarian men, they need to be healthy from much earlier age. So they will probably die sooner if they get a chronic disease early in life. So they won't reach the age of 100 if they get a chronic disease before the age of 80. So as a man, it's much more important to stay in better fitness and metabolic health and body composition than women. The reasons why it is so is not clear. Some people think that it's estrogen that protects women against heart disease mostly until menopause. So women have 4 to 5 decades of their life with very low atherosclerotic, this plaque burden, whereas it only starts to kick off after menopause. Whereas men, it starts at much earlier for them. So they accumulate this atherosclerotic plaque already at a much younger age. So they reach the critical threshold of heart disease and cardiovascular events much sooner. So that's why they die at a younger age as well compared to women. That's one of the theories. And another theory is hormones as well, that men have higher androgens and testosterone that have a negative effect on lifespan. So there are some very interesting studies about eunuchs, so castrates, men who are castrated live longer than regular men for some reason. So they produce less testosterone, and maybe that's one of the reasons. But, you know, it's not a very quality evidence, but that's one of the theories, that this testosterone and androgen, especially DHT and others, they might like accelerate aging in men or increase the risk of heart disease mostly.
So basically, to recap, if you're a survivor, if you get a chronic disease earlier in life, it's less likely that you'll become a centenarian. That's why there's less survivors, but it is still possible. Does any disease qualify? So basically, I've had anemia in the past. Does that mean I'm automatically, if I become a centenarian, I'm automatically in the survivor category?
I don't think anemia counts as like a chronic disease. So, I mean, anemia is associated with increased mortality, but that's possibly because of other things. It's not something that leaves like a permanent imprint in your biology the same way smoking or diabetes would, or kidney disease or something like that. So like once you fix anemia, then, you know, it's pretty much, it doesn't have permanent damage in your physiology. Whereas, you know, with smoking, there's the concept of pack years. The longer you smoke, the more you smoke, the more damage it causes to your body. Yeah, the longer you smoke, the more pack years you accumulate, and the higher the pack years, you know, the higher the risk of cancer and heart disease later in life. And the same for diabetes. If you get diagnosed with diabetes much earlier in life, that that is associated with a shorter life expectancy, whereas that difference shrinks later in life. So if you get diagnosed with diabetes when you're 80 years old, then that's associated with a much smaller reduction in life expectancy, something like maybe 2 years, 2 to 3 years shorter life expectancy compared to regular 80-year-olds. Whereas if you get diagnosed with diabetes in your 30s, that's associated with up to 20 years shorter life expectancy compared to regular 30-year-olds.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, actually, one of the most fascinating things I read in the book was, I guess it was a study, but you were saying that centenarians, in their blood markers, they tend to have actually poorer kidney and liver biomarkers, but good blood glucose and trigs. What do you think might be indicated there? Enjoying their wine?
Well, I mean, kidney function is something that will decline naturally with age. I think it's just the wear and tear of the organism. So if you're 100 years old, your kidneys have had to do a lot of work, even if you've been a healthy person. Just, you know, 100 years is a long time. But with the metabolic health, it's just that they are otherwise healthy. So the only downside will be some organ failure eventually. So you're going to have to die to something, right? Even if it's not heart disease, it's going to be some other organ failure. Kidney disease is very common. You know, there's going to be some cause of death at the extreme of life. So if you're 120 years old, then your cause of death is most likely to be just aging itself or some organ failure because of the wear and tear. So that's, you know, the reason there's this hypothetical limit to the human life expectancy, that the body just wears itself out. Now, some people think that the limit is actually 150, that we are capable of sustaining the organism until the 150 years of age. But so far, no one has, you know, reached that. The longest living person is John Clement, who lived to the age of 122. She's, like an extreme outlier in terms of longevity. The second person, longest living person, is 119, some woman from Japan. So there's a three-year gap between the first and the second longest living person.
And you talk about the different aging clocks and problems with them, well, benefits and problems with them in the book. I was actually really interested. I did True Diagnostic because I had Matt Dawson on the show, and he's CEO of True Diagnostic. And they have Omic Age, the Pace Age with Duke and Columbia, and then Symphony Age from Yale. And he actually, this like blew my mind, because I always wonder if like what I'm doing is working. And he told me my Pace aging score was one of the lowest ones he'd ever seen, which honestly, I did not expect. But at the same time, like I've done so many different aging clocks. Like I've done that one. I've just done quite a few. And it's really interesting because a lot of them will actually conflict each other, like with things they say. Do you take stock in, not literally, but maybe, you know, do you do aging clocks? Do you have thoughts on them? Where do you think they're going?
I think that I'll say what some experts like Matt Caberlin thinks, who I think is one of the like leading longevity scientists in the world. But for, according to him, they're good research tools in the laboratory, but these commercial clocks tend to just use, I guess they try to use the same clocks, but they're somehow different. And these commercial clocks, because of that reason, are wildly inaccurate and can give, you know, very different results. So he did like four of these tests at the same time, and each test twice. So he did like eight tests in one go in the same sitting, and he got very wide, different results, even the same tests. So he took the two diagnostic tests, and both of them varied by something like 4 or 5 years with the result. There's research that the time of the day influences the results of these clocks, whether or not you've been sick recently, if you had some infection or some high inflammation, then that will affect the results. Pregnancy will increase the result. So there's a lot of things that just cause a lot of noise in these clocks, these commercial clocks at least. What he thinks is that these research clocks can be more useful and accurate, and he believes, they are going to be used a lot in clinical research in the future, but the commercial clocks apparently don't have the same accuracy. And I tend to agree with him. I've also done a few of these tests different clocks and they give all different results. So you don't know which one is the most accurate. Like the layman will have no idea. Also, there's a lot of variability, yeah, even if you test around the same time. And even if you do, let's say, try to find some sort of a standardized setting, then you'll never know exactly what's the best time to test it. Because you might have some sort of heavy metal poisoning or mold poisoning or something else that doesn't feel like sickness. You might not feel that you're sick at all, but there is some like higher inflammation status that would skew the results. So it's kind of a waste of money in that case, because you don't never know if this is the best time to test. Even if you get a result, there's nothing specific that you can really do. So let's say whatever result you get, you know, if the biological age score is 5 years lower than your chronological age, or if it's 5 years higher, your lifestyle decisions will be probably the same. You'll still try to, you know, exercise, try to eat healthier, try to sleep more, all those things. Like you would just still do the same things. So it doesn't really matter actually what the biological age, I guess, yeah, like it wouldn't be fair to call them even biological age tests, because they don't apparently measure biological age. They measure maybe like inflammation status, which is then correlated with some chronological age data. Yeah, I wouldn't say that they're biological age clocks. They're more like some inflammation status derivatives or correlations with chronological age.
Hi, friends. Would you like to have the most epic eating experience? I'm talking eradicate bloating and better absorb your nutrients. If so, you need digestive enzymes. These are one of my most favorite supplements out of everything I take, and I truly cannot imagine my life without them. Digestive enzymes are key to break down your food into usable nutrition and to stop things like bloating, digestive distress, constipation, all the things. That's why I created Avalon X Digest. And you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us. You can also get a subscription and save 15%, which you can pause or cancel at any time. Friends, I worked so hard to create the perfect blend of enzymes for Avalon X Digest. It's a full-spectrum, plant-based enzyme blend with proteases to help you break down protein, amylase for carbs, lipase for fats, cellulase for fiber, and so much more. In fact, there are 13 different types of enzymes in this blend. I cannot tell you how many people have told me that when they take Avalon X Digest, they experience no digestive distress with meals. These are truly game changers. And for any of you guys looking to up your protein intake, Avalon X Digest will help you actually break down and assimilate your protein so you get more protein from your meals. I wanted to create the highest potency enzymes so that you get all of these benefits when you eat with no problematic fillers or ingredients. Avalon X Digest is also tested multiple times for purity and potency, comes in glass bottles, and is truly the best enzymes on the market. And again, you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us.
Okay, so is it more viable then to like, and more accessible for people to be measuring things like CRP and homocysteine and, you know, inflammatory markers?
There's definitely a lot more clinical evidence and a lot more other epidemiological studies and just a lot more data about regular blood markers. Like we know high blood sugar is bad, high inflammation is associated with pretty much all chronic diseases, you know, high blood pressure, etc. So we know a lot more about these regular blood markers, whereas with these epigenetic age clocks there are a few studies, but the commercial tests probably don't use the exact same clocks as the research clocks are. So even then they're still not the same as the actual research clocks. But there is one PhenoAge, which is calculated from something like 10 blood markers. So CRP, glucose, creatinine, white blood cells, lymphocytes, MCV, RDW, and a few others. So you can estimate your biological age with these blood markers. It's not a perfect test because obviously your blood markers will fluctuate, you know, day by day. So your biological age will also can go up and down a few years based on this test. But at least you'll have some more practical takeaway as well, that you can see, okay, you're kidneys or your liver is lacking, so you'll be able to do like something specific about it. Whereas with a general epigenetic age clock, there's very little practical takeaway from the results.
How often do you do your blood work?
2 times a year, I do like a comprehensive panel, so something 180 markers, maybe once or twice, 3, 4, depending on the situation. I test some individual markers, usually if I'm like experimenting with something or if I'm tracking something specifically. I don't think everyone needs to, you know, test that much. Once a year, some core markers is well enough. What matters more is, yeah, are you trying to improve something, or is there something that needs to be fixed or improved? So someone might have blood sugar problems. You know, for that person, it's more important to test insulin sensitivity and blood sugar markers more frequently to see if things are improving. Someone might be at a very high risk of heart disease for, you know, family, because of family history or some other already present plaque or something like that, then for them it's more important to track their lipids and blood pressure and other inflammatory markers. So it depends a lot on the individual how often and what they should test, but some of the core markers everyone should test, you know, at least once a year would be, you know, like a lipid panel, blood sugar markers, complete metabolic panel, electrolytes, liver enzymes, kidney markers, you know, some like very basic markers already gives you like a lot of valuable information.
Yeah. And speaking of, so like I mentioned earlier, your chapter on cardiovascular disease risk and the whole complicated world of HDL, LDL, all the things was so eye-opening. I love that chapter. Where have you landed on the arguments or, you know, discussions surrounding the cost benefit of higher cholesterol? You know, there's a lot of people in the keto world who say LDL can be high as long as HDL is high. But you point out some really interesting things about, you know, even high HDL can be oxidative. And what are your thoughts on this whole world? I know it's a big question.
Right. Well, you know, what matters is people discuss cholesterol and lipids because they are considered a risk factor for heart disease, and a heart disease is the biggest cause of death in the world. 1/3 of people will die to some form of cardiovascular disease. So it's not like a minor issue. And that's why people tend to get heated about it, I think. So, you know, what matters at the end of the day is, do you have heart disease or not? The same way with diabetes. So like, do you have diabetes or not? So you can eat, you know, 1,000 grams of carbs a day and not get diabetes. Likewise, someone can have insanely high LDL and ApoB and not get heart disease. So not have any plaque accumulation and not have any soft plaque or hard plaque at all. And but the same applies to like someone can smoke to 100 years old and not die. So, you know, it's like, okay, what does it, so there's always outliers, but generally speaking, in most people, a higher amount of lipids is going to increase the risk of heart disease. And even if there are some people that it wouldn't, or that the risk is not as high, then even then, like, okay, what is the cost to benefit ratio? Like, what is the risk analysis here? Like, is it something that you need to have? Do you need to have extremely high LDL and ApoB or not? You know, maybe for some people, being on a carnivore, low-carb, keto diet helps them to stay in normal body weight and maintain normal blood sugar, and they just can't sustain any other diet. So maybe for them, this high lipid profile might be worth it, because the consequences of not following that diet would be diabetes or obesity, right? Whereas for other people, you know, for me at least, I don't need to be on a low-carb, very high-fat diet to maintain normal metabolic health and normal body composition. I actually do better with a high-carb diet than a lower-fat diet. So that's just me, for example. So I don't have a physiological and a psychological reason to be following a diet that would increase my lipids and cholesterol very high for me. So there is no like health benefits to having insanely high lipids. something like 300 milligrams per deciliter or even like 150 milligrams per deciliter isn't physiologically necessary. The physiological requirements for LDL are, you know, quite low. They look at the studies on hunter-gatherers and infants. They have, you know, very low LDL and very low ApoB and other lipids, something like 70 milligrams per deciliter, which is actually considered to be like a very low risk of atherosclerotic plaque accumulation if your LDL is below 70 milligrams per deciliter. So there's no physiological requirement to have insanely high lipids. Now, some people say that your brain is made of cholesterol, so therefore having high cholesterol is somehow good for the brain. Well, the issue is that none of the cholesterol in your blood actually reaches the brain. It doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. So your brain, yes, is made of cholesterol, but all of that cholesterol is made inside the brain. It's made there with the help of insulin. So insulin that gets demonized actually makes the cholesterol inside your brain. And insulin sensitivity is a huge regulator of body composition, or insulin sensitivity in the brain. So central insulin sensitivity regulates your body composition, your appetite, as well as there's brain cholesterol levels. So my you know, opinion about it is that what I do for myself is that I want to minimize the risk of heart disease because it's the biggest killer, it's the biggest likelihood as a man that I will die to. So I just want to reduce the risk. Obviously, I pay attention to all the risk factors. LDL isn't, you know, the biggest risk factor out there. Diabetes and smoking are a significantly higher risk factor, but LDL isn't like a zero chance. It's not a 0% risk factor either. Just having it lower in my eyes just makes more rational sense. And it's not even the LDL that is, you know, the causal factor. It's more so the ApoB that is the considered to be the causal factor for plaque accumulation and heart disease. So ApoB is this tag on the lipoproteins that get carried around in the bloodstream, and each lipoprotein can have only one ApoB tag. So the amount of ApoB in your blood reflects the amount of lipoproteins. So how many of these vehicles that carry lipids are in the blood. Plaque accumulation isn't determined by the amount of cholesterol, but it is determined, or the risk is higher with a higher amount of particles. So the particle number is what actually leads to the plaque accumulation. So you can think of it like a traffic jam. A traffic jam isn't determined by the amount of people in a amount of area or in this cross section. It's determined by the amount of vehicles. So you can have two buses full of 100 people each, and those two buses aren't going to collide and cause an accident. But if you have, you know, 50 vehicles with 50 individuals, then you will have a traffic accident at some point. So the amount of the lipid, the amount of lipoproteins is what actually drives heart disease. And ApoB is a reflection of the amount of lipoproteins in the blood. And the doctors use LDL as a screening tool mostly for assessing risk, because there is a pretty good correlation between the amount of LDL and ApoB. So it's, LDL is considered like a poor man's ApoB, because if you have very high LDL, then it is likely that you will also have high ApoB, at least in most cases. Now, there is like something like 25% of cases where it isn't the case. It's called like this discordance, but it mostly happens in people with metabolic disease and diabetes. So someone with diabetes can have very low LDL, but still extremely high ApoB, which is because of their metabolic condition. But in most people, like otherwise healthy, metabolically healthy people, having high LDL would also correlate to a higher ApoB. And a higher ApoB is considered like a causal factor in heart disease. Now, of course, it's not the only risk factor, like I said. And a lot of people say that if you have low inflammation, then your risk of plaque accumulation is non-existent, according to some people. But the truth is that inflammation obviously increases the risk. It exacerbates the risk. So yes, if your endothelium is inflamed, then the lipoproteins are more likely to get stuck there and start to trigger this process of atherosclerosis. But it is possible to develop atherosclerosis even without inflammation. So inflammation is just one thing, something that exacerbates the risk, and diabetes exacerbates the risk, but they're all risk factors. So my opinion is to try to minimize all the risk factors, not just one or two. You know, I already have optimal insulin sensitivity and blood sugar levels. I also have optimal inflammation levels. So the last thing that I would want to optimize would be my lipids. So I want to minimize all the risk factors, not just one or two, and being selective about them.
Yeah, I'm so fascinated by all of this. I've noticed for me, I feel like I'm looking through some of my results now. I guess I wish I'd been testing my ApoB for longer than I have, because my LDL has fluctuated in the past a lot, and I'm curious if that would match a fluctuation in my ApoB. Yeah, a few different thoughts here. You said it now, and you said it in the book as well, and I've thought this before. I've thought about this a lot, because people, like, especially in the low carb and keto world, will be like, oh, it's fine to exist in this state of really, really high cholesterol because there's no inflammation, so it's all fine. And I'm like, well, I mean, you don't know that what if you get into an inflammatory state tomorrow and now there's all of this, you know, cholesterol potential to, you know, be a problem.
Yeah, it's like forest fires, you know, in a dry season. You could not have a fire at all if you get lucky, but having a lot of dry wood in that forest will increase the likelihood that if there is a match that gets lit, then everything is going to burn. So the better strategy is to clear out the dry wood as much as possible. And in so doing, you also minimize the risk, even if there is going to be a match that gets drawn. And there was this, you know, recent keto CTA study that looked, so like I said, what matters is, do you actually get heart disease or not? And heart disease is mostly diagnosed with the presence of plaque in the arteries. So like either soft plaque or heart plaque, the calcium in the coronary arteries. But the calcium is already like this late stage event. So there's already been damage, and the calcium is there to like stabilize the plaque. But it is already a characteristic that there has been damage, and it is categorized as already existing heart disease. So this is a keto CTA study did find that these lean mass hyperresponders, as they're called, they have, you know, high LDL, but they're relatively lean and with otherwise good metabolic health. But so these individuals still had plaque progression regardless of being metabolically healthy and having low inflammation. So, you know, there's a lot of controversy about that study, and the authors are discussing it all the time online, but it didn't show that these individuals had zero plaque accumulation over the course of these 2 years that they were tested, or however years that it was. I don't recall exactly, but the point is that they still had plaque progression despite being otherwise metabolically healthy.
I'll have on people who are really, really intense in the vegan world. Like, I've had Dr. Michael Greger and Neil Bernard and people like that. And they'll often say in their work that, like, if you follow like an animal-based diet in any capacity, it's going to really raise your cholesterol. I eat a lot of animal protein, but I don't eat high fat. And I mean, my LDL will be like in the 40s. And so I'm like, clearly it can't be that causative. Like, it can't literally cause, like, animal protein itself, if I'm eating this much animal protein and having low LDL. But if I were to add, I'll look through my history. When I go low carb and I add more fats, everything does shoot up. Those are not normally animal fats. They're normally like coconut oil and things like that, like plant-based fats. So it's really just really interesting.
Yeah, the biggest driver of increased LDL levels are saturated fat. And I think it's also the low carb element that might raise it, or like there's like some of these something related to the lipid transport, that if your body utilizes more fat for fuel, then it also has higher cholesterol levels in the blood, because the cholesterol is transported in the same vehicles as fat, the triglycerides. So if you are in a low carb or ketogenic state, then you'll just have higher LDL by virtue of being low carb. Whereas you can easily shift your cholesterol levels and lipids with insulin, or, you know, raising insulin by eating something like carbs. And it doesn't even have to be like, you know, massive amounts of carbs. Even just like a sweet potato or some broccoli or something like that can probably change it already quite significantly.
It's like that guy who did that study. That guy, I sound so specific. That guy though, who did that study, I think it was last year, and he added like Oreos to his low carb diet and dropped his cholesterol. It created a lot of headlines, but it sounds like that concept that you just mentioned. So that makes sense. And then you also mentioned, like, people think HDL, we want it, you know, super high all the time, but you actually mentioned that it actually can be oxidative as well, especially over like, what was it, 80 or 85, I think?
Yeah, I think something above 100, I think, is associated with increased heart disease mortality as well. But the reason probably may have to do with that if you have such high HDL, you also have high other lipids. So it would be extremely rare to have a HDL of like 100 and LDL of, you know, 50 or something like that. But yeah, like HDL can also be oxidized. But I think the biggest risk comes from that if you have very high HDL, then you tend to have very high LDL as well.
Hi, friends. You guys know I am obsessed with safe, effective skincare. One of my favorite skincare brands of all time, which is USDA Certified Organic, yes, actually Certified Organic, is Purity Woods. And friends, I'm going to be completely honest here. I already had a few skincare brands that I loved when I first found Purity Woods. So I was like, okay, another skincare brand. It was going to take a lot for me to actually add something new into my routine. Oh my goodness. The second I tried Purity Woods, it became a complete non-negotiable. And when I interviewed the founder, Brian Vasily, on my podcast, that's when I learned why. Brian discovered the astounding clinically studied benefits of organic maple leaf extract for the skin. Maple leaf extract contains antioxidant and hydrating properties that help soothe irritated or inflamed skin while also helping to plump, brighten, and nourish the appearance of your skin. So we're talking skin firming, anti-aging, all the things. It's sometimes even called plant-based Botox because of how effective it is. There are three of their products that I use every single day and night of my life. That would be their age-defying dream cream, which I use, yes, during the day, their age-defying night cream, which I use at night, and their hyperlift serum, which I use both morning and night. Every time I put these products on my skin, I just have this sigh of relief. They feel that good, they smell wonderful, I see the effects of my skin, and I just love them that much. And as you know, I am neurotic about having non-toxic ingredients. These products are incredible. You could eat them, but please don't eat them. And Purity Woods has an incredible offer for you guys. You can get up to 38% off at puritywoods.com/Melanie. Turn back time on the appearance of your skin with Purity Woods Age-Defying Dream Cream. Go to puritywoods.com/Melanie at checkout for up to 38% off. That's puritywoods.com/Melanie. I am obsessed with Purity Woods and I can't wait for you guys to try it as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then you also, well, speaking of something I appreciate as well, you commented somewhere in the book that I'm paraphrasing, but basically we shouldn't be prescribing like low carb for health based on studies in sick people. So like if low carb is fixing things and people who have issues where it fixes it, that doesn't necessarily mean we should prescribe it for everybody.
Yeah. And you know, ketogenic diets are possibly useful for various conditions. You know, it's historically used for epilepsy, but there's some clinical trials over the last few years showing it helps with like depression or IBD and, you know, various other medical conditions. So, of course, it's a medical tool that we can use for people that can benefit from it. But let's say an otherwise healthy individual, lean, athletic, no issues with metabolic health, you know, it doesn't make sense for them to be on that kind of a restrictive diet when there's nothing in carbohydrates or, you know, being on a non-ketogenic diet, there's nothing in on a non-ketogenic diet that would be harmful to them. There's no evidence that, you know, carbohydrates in of themselves would be somehow deleterious to health in otherwise healthy people. And some of the studies yet indicate that in lean, healthy individuals, it might be more net negative because of the increased lipids. So, you know, everyone can, you know, decide what kind of a diet they follow as long as they know the risks and benefits. But more often than not, people may be on the, such diets because of being misinformed or because of thinking that they need to do it. So, you know, yeah, carbohydrates aren't necessarily harmful for otherwise healthy individuals, but low carb diets can be useful tools for some conditions.
I like that you point out like the common factor between all the diets that seem to work is that they eschew whole foods, unprocessed foods, that they are based on whole foods, not the store, but the type of food. Something I'm dying to ask you. So I'm also the host of the Intermittent Fasting podcast, and we discuss this concept all the time. And for listeners, there is a huge chapter on like calorie restriction and fasting and all of these things. So with fasting, this is like the million-dollar question. Do you think the benefits are just due to it creating calorie restriction, or is it separate from that or additional to that?
The animal research suggests that fasting without calorie restriction doesn't have life extension effects. So a lot of the benefits that you might see from intermittent fasting comes from the achieved calorie restriction. Or I guess the more better way to say it would be that if you are doing intermittent fasting, but you're not calorie restricted and you're gaining weight and you're overweight, then it's not going to have longevity benefits. Whereas being in a semi-calorie restricted state and not gaining weight and not being obese, that is what drives the benefits that you might see from intermittent fasting if someone were to do it. And maybe the time of the day could be a factor. So the circadian rhythm component, there is some mouse research that eating the food in the active phase, so for mice it's evening or in the nighttime, but for humans it would be the daytime, that that would increase lifespan, whereas doing the opposite of having this circadian mismatch, eating at nighttime would shorten lifespan in those mice in a calorie restricted state. So and with intermittent fasting, so there is an element of truth to intermittent fasting that you don't want to be eating at the wrong time. You don't want to be eating at the middle of the night, and you want to be eating like at irregular times. But it's mostly like a tool for people to achieve a calorie deficit and to maintain a healthy body weight. So I like to do intermittent fasting because it's just easy and I enjoy it, and it helps me to stay to a lower calorie intake and helps me to maintain good body composition year round. Whereas for someone else, they might not experience that. They might fall off the rails with their diet, they might overeat when they break the fast, etc. So those situations would indicate that it's not the more optimal way of eating for them. So they might do something else. But it's a good tool for some people to lose weight without necessarily counting calories if it is the right thing for them.
Do you know if mice have the circadian rhythm chronotypes that we see in humans, like being like early birds and night owls?
I'm not exactly sure yet if there are chronotypes in mice. I would imagine there might be some differences between individual mice, but mice are nocturnal, so that they have the flipped circadian rhythm. Yeah, that they're nocturnal animals. Yeah.
The reason I'm wondering, because I know that one of the arguments for the chronotype, the sleep chronotypes, is that as a species, somebody needed to be awake all the time to protect the tribe. That's what I've heard. I don't know if mice are protecting the tribe, but I'm just curious because, like, for me, I just gravitate towards, it's interesting to hear what you're saying about, eating during the day. And I just really gravitate towards eating later, like at night. Like, that's just intuitively feels good to me. And I'm always haunted perpetually by, should I be a breakfast eater? Yeah. What are you like a chronotype wise?
Well, I'm definitely like a morning person in terms of my daytime activities. I don't eat immediately breakfast. I have my first meal of the day, which is just a protein shake at 10 a.m. And my dinner is slightly earlier, so it's 4 p.m. at where I have my dinner. And I go to bed something like 10 p.m. So I think I'm not like a very early, super early chronotype, but, earlier than a lot of other people. So what I think matters is that you should try and experiment what works for you. what makes you feel the best, what helps you to achieve the best body composition, and what improves your sleep the most. So I think having good sleep is more important than any particular intermittent fasting window. So the potential negative side effects of eating too late could be you don't want your eating window to disrupt your sleep quality. I think that's quite an important factor, and that differs between a lot of people. Some people like to eat later and they sleep fine. Other people need to stop eating very early. I've come to my particular eating window just through experimentation. 5 years ago, even I was also eating my last meal at 8 p.m., 9 p.m. or something like that even. But I've just, biggest reason was that because I got married. My wife wants to have a slightly earlier dinner. We started with 6 p.m. We did 5 p.m. Then we both hey, actually 4 p.m. feels pretty good. I like to go to bed with a slightly emptier stomach. So I've, gotten used to it, and I actually prefer it now after changing it over the course of multiple years gradually. But there's no clear research that one is better or the other. Now, there is research that morning chronotypes, so people who wake up slightly earlier, have a lower mortality and lower risk of heart disease. But, that's obviously can be skewed by this healthy user bias, that people who go to bed very late, they might have unhealthier lifestyles, they might drink and stay up late, and people who wake up early, they are these people who go out for a run and eat otherwise healthy, etc. So it's not, causal relationship between chronotypes and mortality risk. So it's hard to say if it is actually important to be a morning person or not. I wouldn't say that everyone needs to change their chronotype based on that research, but I would say that, just pay attention to your sleep and try to optimize your nutrition around your sleep, because it's quite important. It's a very important aspect of health and longevity.
Yeah, I wonder if because I just love sleep. I as of right now, I perceive that I cannot sleep on an empty stomach. So I wonder if I were to shift it earlier, if I actually would enjoy, like you said, going to sleep on an empty stomach. I don't know. That's such a wild concept to me.
You might be different. And I think I sleep better and deeper if I have a slightly empty stomach, but some people just can't do it. So
I will say, on the sleep factor, one of my favorite studies that you found, this was really good to read. It was a 2023 study, and it was looking at 5 favorable sleep factors to increase life expectancy by 4.7 years in men and 2.4 years in women. And so they were, for the audience, 1, sleeping 7 to 8 hours per night. 2, having difficulty falling asleep less than or equal to 2 times a week. So you can still have trouble falling asleep 2 times a week. 3, trouble staying asleep less than or equal to 2 times a week. Not using sleep medication. And then 5, feeling well rested after waking up greater than or equal to 5 times a week. So basically, you don't have to have perfect sleep to see the increase in life expectancy. I still say get all the sleep, but reading this, I don't know, it's really helpful, because I think people can get neurotic about sleep.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a kind of a pendulum swing that people neglected sleep 10 years ago, but now everyone is very obsessed with sleep. So the truth is that sleep is important, and you need to try to sleep as well and as long as you can, because life gets in the way and you're going to not sleep well and not as long, occasionally. So if you can, just don't restrict your sleep as well as and as long as you can, whenever you can, because otherwise you'll still develop a deficit over time because of life that happens. But you don't need to be 100% perfect with your sleep. So the reason you would want to be trying to be perfect is just to kind of bank your sleep, have a good accumulation of sleep before you get sleep deprived because of life. But there's nothing that if you sleep 5 hours a night on some nights, that it somehow depletes your sleep bank or depletes your life expectancy somehow. That if you have one bad night's sleep, or even one restless, completely sleepless night, then it doesn't mean that you're cutting your life short immediately.
Yeah, I think it can be really helpful for people. I mean, I am all about sleep and like trying to optimize it. It's just helpful to know that it's okay if every now and then you have some issues.
Yeah, and naps are like a very cool and good thing to counteract that. So people who take slightly shorter naps, so less than 30 minutes, even if done multiple times a week, they have lower mortality and lower heart disease compared to people who take very long naps, up to 1.5 hours. So like short naps are very useful and great ways to mitigate some of sleep loss and increase your sleep reserve.
Do you take naps?
Yeah, I take almost every other day. I go through some periods I go through like every day, some periods I go through like a month without a nap. So it depends, yeah, just how much sleep am I getting at the night.
So my hack, I call it my sauna nap, because I have the Sunlight and Solo unit that you lie down in. So I'll take a nap in my sauna, and it's kind of like getting a detox cardiovascular exercise while sleeping. It works really well for me.
That's, yeah, nice.
Just to put a bow on the fasting thing, I did ask for questions for you, but I knew I wouldn't get to like any of them because I had all my own questions. But I have this question as well. Marissa wanted to know, are incorporating longer fasts, meaning over 24 or 36 hours on a weekly basis, helping or harming longevity? And I know you did conclude in your book that there's not a ton of data showing, or you can let me know what you found about data for fasting over 24 hours, like the benefits.
Yeah, there's not a lot of studies on that in, you know, otherwise healthy people. There are some medical fasts, you know, they're for multiple days, but you can't make any, let's say, longevity conclusions from that for healthy people, because they're usually done in overweight individuals. And there are like studies about this fasting mimicking diet and alternative fasting that also show that they lower blood pressure, lower blood sugar, lower cholesterol, lower body weight, etc. But how big of an effect would it have in otherwise healthy individuals already, then that we can't know. So it's very hard to obviously do lifespan studies in humans. It's, you know, pretty much impossible, especially something with fasting or a diet. But the animal research suggests that fasting in of itself without any calorie restriction wouldn't extend lifespan. It would only do so if you're also calorie restricted at the same time. But calorie restriction without intermittent fasting would give the same results. So the most important thing is to not be overweight, not be diabetic, not have, you know, high amounts of body fat and visceral fat and high amounts of other medical or metabolic ailments. I think that's the most important takeaway.
Yeah. And just to mention that when you're speaking about the calorie restriction, you also pointed out a really interesting study that talked about how intermittent calorie restriction was superior to continual calorie restriction, which is pretty interesting in fact to think about. What's the longest fast you've done?
I've done 7 days. I think it was 6 years ago, 7 years ago.
Oh, wow. Was it a good experience? Or were you like, I'm not doing this again?
Well, of course, it's a very interesting experience. Mostly that you realize that nothing happens if you don't eat even as multiple days. So, you know, it can be useful, I guess, exposure therapy for some people who might need it. But yeah, I don't like miss it either. You know, I don't think it's inherently necessary. You know, and I think that, you know, some people probably will find them more useful. So some individuals might like the idea of doing alternative fasting more than just eating less every day. But other people, you know, I guess prefer to have smaller meals and just restrict calories on a daily basis rather than to not eat at all. I think most people would find that option easier. But some other individuals, you know, I'll just do a 3-day fast once a month or once a week, and that will be enough for me to lose weight, and I can eat whatever else at other times. So yeah, it depends a lot on the individual. But, you know, I guess the risk here is the muscle preservation. I don't think you'll lose muscle with a 2-3-day fast if you're, you know, younger. It might be problematic if you're older, so like 60s or 70s. I wouldn't really recommend extended fasts for people that age. But if you're, you know, less than 40 or in your 40s, you can easily get away with multi-day fasting and not lose muscle and just lose a lot of body fat. But, you know, is it worth it? That depends a lot, again, on the individual.
I feel like that's like the theme of our other show. We're just like, you have to find what works for you, which always feels like a cop-out answer, but it's so true about the individuality of everything.
You know, so most people aren't going to do like DEXA scans and see if they lose muscle or not between their fasts. So it's hard to say if they are moving in the right direction or not, unless they're doing it for multiple years, and then you can see some trends. So if you're otherwise progressing at the gym and you're otherwise progressing in your body composition and you're progressing in your metabolic health and biomarkers, then you probably don't need to change. But if things are heading in the wrong direction, you are progressively getting weaker, you're not progressing at the gym, you're feeling more tired, and your body composition doesn't get better, you actually become more skinny fat, then that's like a sign that you're heading in the wrong direction.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you end, I think you, maybe it was, I'm not sure if it was the last chapter. Somewhere near the end, you talk about purpose and gratitude and like mindset, how that all affects longevity. So I'm curious, and for listeners, we only like barely skim the surface of everything in this book. So definitely go get it now. What have you identified as your life purpose?
My life purpose as an anthropologist, it is to safeguard the transition in the development of the human species, so that we don't mess things up in the next few decades with AI and life extension technologies. But as a human being, as a regular human being, it is to just live my life with my friends and family and my wife, and to leave the world like a better place than it was before.
Well, you're definitely doing that. I just have to ask, I'm really curious. So do you think we're doomed with AI, or what do you think about the future?
I don't think we're doomed. I think it's going to be like a net positive in many aspects.
Okay, that's good. I use it like daily, and I just wonder if it's taking notes. I feel like I'm probably on its bad list because I call it out on a lot of things. I cannot handle it when it hallucinates and stuff. So I don't know. I'm normally a very nice person, but I'm not very nice to AI. So, oh dear. Well, this has been absolutely amazing. Again, friends, get the Longevity Leap. It will blow your mind on all things aging, extending your life, adding healthy years, all the things. Are you writing another book now, Seem?
Yeah, I'm writing a book with, so this is a co-project again. It's with Dr. James, Danica Lantonio, and my wife. We're three of us writing a book about supplements. So it's like a going to be like an encyclopedia of supplements. So it's not a narrative book. It's about, each chapter is each supplement, and what does the research say about that supplement?
Oh, that will be very helpful. Well, I'd love to have you back, any of you guys, for that, because that sounds awesome. And yeah, like I said, a really good resource. Well, thank you so much. The last question that I ask every single guest on this show, and it's just because I do appreciate mindset a lot, which by the way, Seem does talk about in the book, and you can improve or enhance or increase your positive mindset if you're not naturally inclined that way. What is something that you're grateful for?
Right now, I'm grateful that I can do my work and not have to struggle for survival as a lot of people did in the past. So I think, right now is the best time to be alive, despite what the impression people might get on social media. I think, now is the much better time to be alive than even 100 years ago.
I cannot agree more. I think about this all the time. Like, things were wild back then. And one of my favorite fun facts is, margins on paper, like the margins. Do you know why they're there?
To not write over the margins.
So they are there because it used to be so common that you would leave your papers out at night and rats would eat your paper, eat the sides of the paper, that they started adding margins to allow for the rats to eat the paper. Like that's how, and that wasn't that long ago. So like we have it really good now. You know, we're not going to bed with like rat infested houses and, you know, like you said, struggling to survive. And so, in any case, thank you so much. I am so grateful for everything that you're doing. I eagerly always look forward to your books, and you're really, like you said, leaving the world a better place. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your time, and would love to have you back in the future.
Yeah, well, it was great to talk with you, and thank you.
Have a good night.
You too.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information and resources, you can check out my book, What, When, Wine, as well as my supplement line, Avalon X. Please visit melanieavalon.com to learn more about today's guest, and always feel free to contact me at contact@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.